Dark Wreath Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 7. Lecture 23, delivered on November 12, 2009. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 2.
Today, review for exam 2.
Same format as last time. Multiple guess or multiple choice, then a matching section, and then your math workout section, and then your short answers. Same number of short answers, 5. Now, let me hit the math section first. You will have a marginal cost of capital question. And here's how it'll work. I'm going to put up the narrative on the web Sunday night. On the exam, all you will have to do is calculate the break points and the marginal costs of capital. You won't have to do the IOS, MCC stuff and all that. All you'll have to do is calculate your breakpoints and your marginal cost of capital, which of course means you're going to have to figure out your cost of component capital. In other words, the cost of debt after taxes, the cost of equity. Now I'm going to tell you something else. You will have 2 breakpoints. One will be a debt breakpoint, and the other will be an equity breakpoint. It'll be a 2 breakpoints. Now, what does that mean in terms of marginal cost of capital? How many marginal costs of capitals will there be if there are 2 breakpoints? 3. I love it when you talk like that. That's right. Someone said 2. 3. Yes, there will be 3 marginal costs of capitals. Okay, and I'll put up the narrative on the web Sunday night. This should not be a sweat question. Just don't make a mistake. Watch it about the dividend. You know, in one problem, I told you the current dividend. And in another problem, I gave you the one-year-out dividend. So look at which one I'm giving you and shape your calculations of K sub S and K sub N appropriately to which one I give you. As long as you don't fall down there, you were good on the problem. It was just you didn't see which one I was looking for. So know which one I'm giving you. Am I giving you D0 or am I giving you D1? If I'm giving you D1, straight up in. If I'm giving you D0, you have to grow it one period. Now, remember there were 2 different ways that I described the dividend. In one case, I told you the dividend per share and the number of shares outstanding. And then you had to subtract that from your, and you had to do some things with that. In another problem, though, I described just the net income and the payout ratio. So if I were to tell you, say, the net income is $2 million, and the dividend payout ratio this company follows is 20%. Let me do it more specifically. The net income expected for next year is $2 million, and the dividend payout ratio is 20%. Okay. And I can tell you the number of shares outstanding is 18 million. Okay, first of all, let's talk here. Am I talking about D0 or D1? D1, because I said the income expected for next year. Okay, now, what is the amount of the total dividend that this company is going to have? How much money are they paying out? $400,000, because it's a payout ratio of 20% on $2 million net. So they've got, where the hell was it? Yeah, so they've got a dividend of $400,000. Now, I said that they had, I meant to say that they have 16 million shares outstanding. So what's the dividend per share? 25 cents, yes. It would be 400,000 divided by 16 million shares. So you got a quarter share dividend. So
I'm only getting
2.5. Oh, you're right. I said that wrong. It would be 2.5 cents on that one. Yeah, I'm trying to think of this on the fly here. But okay, the point there being, and thank you for saying that, is that I've given you D1. You've got your retained earnings, so you'll know how to do the equity breakpoint. So you've got all the information that you're probably going to need to be able to carry this problem through. Just watch how I describe the dividend and the net income and all of that. Am I talking about D0, D1? And make sure that you know how to get to the dividend per share from whatever I give you. I might give it to you straight up. I might give it to you the way I just narrated there. But I will give you this information on the web on Sunday night. Just stay frosty on a problem like this. Just crank it. Now, other problems that I'll give you in the quant section of this exam. Simple, obviously I'll give you present value, future value of annuities, and I'll have you calculate a mortgage payment. I'm not going to throw any curveballs at you with annuity dues. And I won't do any of those where there's this complicated little blip in the annuity that you have to take out and calculate separately or any of that stuff. I'm just going to throw you a pitch straight down the middle and hope that you can just hit a home run with it. I'm not giving you any of that on the web. The only problem I'm giving you on the web is the narrative for the MCC problem. This stuff, you should be able to push this right into your calculator, and provided your calculator doesn't fart on you or you don't key something in wrong, you're in good shape. Okay, these are calculator problems. These are the ones that you can just wash these out real fast, just pumping them in. I'll give you NPV, IRR. You'll have to calculate those. And you know how to do that. These are calculator problems. These are not deep thought problems. I saved that for the last part of the exam. And then I'll have you do bond price and bond yield. Definitely have you do bond price and bond yield. In other words, I'll give you one where I give you everything so that you can find the price of a bond. Then I'll give you another one where I give you everything so that you can find the yield on a bond. Again, no-brainer type of stuff. Remember that I said I anticipate that you will do things semi-annually from now on, like the real world works. So if I tell you that the coupon is 8%, for 10 years, well, then you should be using 4% and 20 periods to calculate the bond's price. Okay? Let me qualify this. I'm not going to have you do something like that, fixed cost, find the fixed cost. But I will have you find a break-even, okay? A break-even. Now, I might do that in multiple choice. Break-even is so easy, it's almost, I don't want to insult your intelligence. Okay, I was like, no, really, please. It's very straightforward. Now, that gives you a pretty good view of the quant section. I'm not telling you that that's everything, but that's a good view of the quant section. I'm giving you the heads up. I'm not throwing you curveballs. I'm telegraphing my punch to you. It's up to you to decide whether you want to take the punch in the chops or want to do one of those matrix things where you slide backwards and all that. As a matter of fact, I've actually finally figured out that anyone can do matrix stuff. All you have to do is sit on a chair and do like, ah, God, I almost heard something I care about doing that. Never mind. Okay. Where the hell was I? God, I gotta quit smoking. That hurt my chest. Okay, now let's get down to, let me go to the matching. Matching, part of the matching is going to be where I write a formula. You'll see some formulas on the left, and you'll have to match them with the name of it on the right. So, for example, if I were to, I just use a blue pen. If I were to write this, W sub D times KT A K A T sub D plus WS k sub s plus w n times k sub n. What would you look for on the right side to match up with that? What term? Yes. Well, okay, you got the first letter right. That's a quarter of a point for it. FTS, you know. OMG, LOL. What is it? That's right, it's weighted average cost of capital. There you go. Were you the one who just said that? No, I was gonna see people all over the world listen to these podcasts. And if it's there might be some very, very gorgeous women somewhere in the world. The man who answered that was very attractive. Turn-ons, long evening walks with a significant other. Turn-offs, men who don't care. Please send me $10 and I will send you a photograph and personal information about this young man. Okay, where the hell was I? Yeah, you'll probably get some woman named Helga from the Volga lands or something. I don't want to know. Dude, no. Okay, where the hell was I? Oh, okay, and I could give you other ones like this. For example, I might write something like this. God. What is that? What would you be looking for in the matching for that one? D1 over piece over the quantity P sub 0 minus F. What's that thing? The cost of externally generated equity or cost of new equity. It's a cost function. D sub 1 over the quantity P0 minus F. So there'll be a couple of those kind of matching ones where you're matching a term to a formula. And then there will be some other ones that would be a little more, qualitative types of things in there too. But don't forget to know the names of things. Know the names of formulas. What is it that this formula represents? There's a usefulness to this in later courses. And when you get out there into the real world, because sometimes you'll see in a later course, they'll be talking about something and they'll be using some kind of an odd term, or you'll see a calculation in a book or maybe in notes that were provided to you for a meeting. And you'll say, wait a minute, I recognize that. That's weighted average cost of capital. They're not calling it that, but that's weighted average cost of capital. And I understand that concept, so I should be able to understand what they are doing with this concept that they are calling by a different name, but using the same formula I used when I was with that great professor at Illinois State University. Or maybe even when you were with me at Illinois State University. Okay, so that, there's a rationale to why I'm doing that in the matching. So keep your heads up on terminology. Now, for your part, do you have any terms that you would like to suggest? And if there's something that I would never ask you in a matching, I'll say, I'm not going to ask you that, you fool. But if I hedge and hem and haw, it could be a legitimate type of matching concept. Is there anything that you would like to ask about? Excuse me. Well, I'll let that... Yeah, go ahead. Modigliani-Miller. Now, that's probably not going to show up there, but I will tell you right now. I'm glad you bring it up. I will ask you in the multiple choice about it, and I will ask you in the short answers about it. The M&M, the Modigliani-Miller proposition. Well, it wasn't that they thought. They said, under our assumptions about the cost of debt, we should see, relative to the cost of new equity, firms should all be 100% debt in their capital structure. The optimal capital structure for every firm should be 100% debt. That was the Modigliani-Miller proposition. Now, they were not stupid. They knew very well that that wasn't how the real world worked. But what they were doing was inviting the conversation about what it is in our basic assumptions that is missing, that makes it so that the optimal capital structure is not in the real world, at least companies don't see it in the real world, as 100% debt. So I will ask you twice about Modigliani-Miller in different contexts. One in the context of the multiple choice, once in the short answers. Yes?
So then, the other part, whether
they're incorrect in assuming the cost of debt is the same. Okay. Now that'll take us into another issue, and which I will probe on the exam. I got to be careful how I word this. Okay. In general, it is reasonable to assume that the cost of debt is less than the cost of equity, existing or new float. There are two reasons why debt should have a lower cost than equity. What are the two reasons, logically, debt is cheaper than equity? One is, go ahead. Interest on debt is tax deductible. So we calculate cost of debt as the cost of debt case of D times 1 minus the tax rate, because the tax rate times case of D is shields income. So there, right there, debt is cheaper than equity because we deduct interest. We cannot deduct dividends from our taxable income. So that was one reason. Then there's another reason debt should be cheaper. And that one's a little bit subtler, but debt should be cheaper because debt has the prior claim on cash flow. You have to pay the debt holders before the equity holders can get anything. Therefore, debt is cheaper because it is less risky. The bond holders face less risk, period, than the shareholders do. The bond holders face less risk than the shareholders do. No question about it. Because the shareholders get what's left after taxes, after all the bills are paid. But the bondholders get their money up front before shareholders can see a dime. And if the company goes under, the debt holders get the carcass. The shareholders get the shaft. So, logically, debt is cheaper than equity. But where the Modigliani-Miller proposition brought us was to recognize what you guys did here in class, that debt does not stay at the same cost. Debt becomes riskier for the lender to provide as the company faces a larger payout in interest against its EBIT. In other words, it is one thing to lend money to a company that has a times interest earned of 10. It is quite another thing and quite a bit riskier to lend money to a company that has a times interest earned of 1.5. Because when the times interest earned is 10, sales can blip a little bit, and you still got enough money to pay your interest. But if you are paying nearly every penny of your earnings before interest and taxes in debt into interest, just a little fart in your sales, you're bankrupt. You're in default. You're gone. The bondholders go to court and say, we want the company. So it becomes riskier. The greater the percentage of your debt, the riskier the lending becomes, and therefore the higher the charge will be. And that's why we saw in the one problem, from zero to $750,000, they would be charged 1% interest rate. And if they borrow more than $750,000, they'd be charged a higher interest rate. The lenders are just going to ratchet up the cost of debt, which means the after-tax cost of debt is going to ratchet up, which means that eventually debt becomes more expensive than equity in the real world. Okay. Yeah, you certainly got me into some good questions there. Okay, now, let me take you into the multiple choice just for a little bit, just to give you some ideas about where I'm going to go. I'm not saying that these are questions that would be on the exam. I'm not saying they're not. But I'm saying, for example, suppose that the marginal cost of capital is below the weighted average cost of capital. What do you know about the weighted average cost of capital in that situation? The marginal cost of capital is below the weighted average cost of capital. So, what would that tell you about the marginal cost of capital if that were ever to happen? Bingo! I love it when you talk like this. You've got to start wearing leather to class, son. Yes, that's exactly right. Now, let's try it the other way.
Can you repeat that real quick?
Okay, watch. This is just that old economics thing that they confuse the hell out of you with in microeconomics class. You've got your weighted average cost of capital, your WAC. You've got your marginal cost of capital, like that. So if the marginal cost of capital, the last dollar you borrow, costs you less than the average dollar you borrow, it's going to, that last dollar of capital you borrow, or whatever, is going to draw the average down. It's like if the class average is 75, and then someone comes in and takes the test, and that person's from Decatur and gets a 50, it's going to pull the average down. Now, in the more realistic scenario, what happens if the marginal cost of capital is larger than the weighted average cost of capital? Yes, it will draw the weighted average cost of capital upward. It will pull the WAC upward. So we should be looking. Okay, now, let me take you back here. Give me a name for the bottoming out point on the weighted average cost of capital curve. What is it? Okay, again, the WAC is shaped like a U. Not necessarily a parabola, maybe more like a catenary or something like that. But that bottoming out point, if the horizontal axis is, huh? Yes, it's the optimal capital structure. See, because if the horizontal axis is the percent of debt in the capital structure, then obviously you're going to go from 0 to 100% debt. So where this point bottoms out, that would be your optimal percent of debt. So basically that's telling you your optimal capital structure. Because it's not only telling you your optimal percentage of debt, it's also telling you your optimal percentage of equity. Now, taking you on another journey, a slightly different journey here, this should, true or false, this should be at 50%. That's right. We don't know where it will be. I mean, different industries, that was what I was honking about the last class. Different industries, you'll see the WAC behave differently. This, yeah.
Does it always have to be the marginal cost of capital and the WAC?
Well, yeah, because the bottom, the low point of the weighted average cost of capital curve will be where it intersects the marginal cost of capital curve. Think of it this way. Marginal cost of capital is always rising. Well, I mean, it can stay level. In our work, we kind of have it do these tiers like that. But in a theoretical sense, marginal cost of capital is always rising. Okay. Now, suppose that you start out with, and let's talk about a test. If I've got an average of 75 and the person from Decatur comes and takes the test and gets a 50, that will pull the test average down, let's say to 70. Then some new last person comes in and takes the test and gets a 60. That would pull the average down to, let's say, 65. Now, suppose the next person that takes the test gets a 65. What's that going to do to the average? It's going to leave it. And then the next person who takes the test gets a 70. That'll pull the average up. So then someone takes the test, gets an 80. That'll pull the average up again to maybe 75. But what you notice is that the bottoming out place is where the marginal, the last, was the average. And that's not an economics or finance thing. That's just a mathematical thing, that those two will always intersect at the bottom of the whack. Now, this takes us into another thing that I will probe in the multiple choice section. You notice in the quantitative section, I said nothing about degree of operating leverage, degree of financial leverage, and degree of combined leverage. That doesn't mean I won't ask about it. It's more likely that I would ask you about that in the multiple choice section. For example, I might give you the degree of operating leverage and the degree of combined leverage and say, what's the degree of financial leverage? Or I might give you a couple of them and ask you to find the third. If you know the formula, it's just a stupid little algebra problem. I mean, I don't want to insult your intelligence. So maybe I shouldn't ask something that easy. Okay, I will. Please, please, really. In the multiple choice part, I probably will ask you something about break-even analysis, do some kind of break-even calculation. Yeah. Well, here's the deal. That would only be true in the quantitative thing, in the quantitative section. And there's really only one place where you'll get a cumulative disaster. That's that MCC problem. And that's where I will have to look at, okay, I'm going to know if you screwed the pooch on calculating the component cost of capital. This is what that will do to the marginal cost of capital. I'm not going to beat you up twice on it. So if you screw the pooch on the first part, I will not mark you down on the second based upon your calculation, what you did on the first. If you did it right for the second, you're in good shape. But if you do this first part right and you blow the second, then it's death from the sky. I turn into an animal that channels the god Cthulhu, and my head turns around and things like that. See, because remember, I'm giving you this quiz, this exam on Tuesday. I will be turning it back on Thursday, which means Tuesday night I will be sitting at Denny's and I will be grading. You won't recognize me because I will have like this glow of fire around me. Yeah, Mabel. Yeah, she's hot. Oh, especially when she wears her apron backwards. God, smoking. Okay, where the hell was I? Really, I'm a professor. I should do better than this. Okay, here we go. Now let me get down to the short answers. Okay, I've already told you something I'm going to ask you right up front, okay? Right up front.
What you're
going to ask us? Well, there's not a whole lot of things. Spell Modigliani. I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to do anything like that. But it's going to, obviously, Modigliani and Miller actually did a lot of work. And the only thing I've told you about is this proposition of theirs, and there's not a whole lot of different ways that I can hit you with it. Remember my rule. First of all, I did want to warn you. Yesterday, I got my bullshit stamp re-inked. Don't make me use it. I will this time. Okay? And then you'll be able to sell it on eBay, your test. But I...
Huh? Yeah. Yep. That pisses me off. God. It's going to be interesting. I'm just so excited to see Thursday's lecture. I shouldn't stay in here for that, but just see how you react to the very different style. But anyway. Remember what I did on that first test where you got in trouble because I used a term and it caught you. You didn't notice that I was actually looking for something very compact. It was when I said, what is the risk structure of an interest rate? And a lot of you went off onto almost like a philosophical discussion. I was actually asking you for something very specific. The risk structure of an interest rate is the sum of the default premium, the maturity premium, and the illiquidity premium. Watch it on this exam. Know the terminology. Because if I hit you with a term, I am looking for you to come back to me with definitional or at least highly descriptive response. I'm looking for something very specific. So don't think that if I use some term that looks a little technical, I'm looking for some open-ended discussion. I'm not. I'm looking for a very specific answer. If you notice the way those questions were, when I gave you the answer to that section on the first exam, I was just going through, well, it's this, 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 this. It was like mechanical stuff. Don't think I'm looking for a lot of philosophical discussion. I probably am not. The worst that I would do to you is to probe something about, again, like I usually do, because I want you to connect this up in some very real ways. Our fearless leader of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, announced earlier this week that the super accommodative monetary policy was going to continue. The Fed was going to continue to hold interest rates down. Now, the bond markets had been very concerned that the Fed was going to have to turn and start fighting the inflation. And Uncle Ben assured everyone, oh, no, not yet. This recovery is too fragile, so we're going to continue to be very accommodative in our monetary policy. So what would you expect that to do to bond prices? Why? Yes. You see, especially if the market had thought old Ben was going to get up there, we are going to start ratcheting up interest rates. If the market expects that, they will react to it before it happens. And then if old Uncle Ben comes up there and says the opposite, then every broker in the country is going to be hopping up and down to realign positions away from the prior expectation. So you are absolutely right. We would expect that if Uncle Ben comes out and says that, we should see bond prices skyrocket, or at least go up pretty nicely, because everyone would have expected him to say interest rates are going up, so everyone would already have pushed bond prices down expecting that, and then when he pulls the rug and says, no, we're not going to do that, then everyone would rush back in and buy bonds again and push the prices back up. So I want you to be able to answer a question. There will be only one like that. And you give me short answers. Remember, these are one-sentence answers. The logic there is quite simple. When you go out there into the business world, when a boss, some important person, asks you a question, he doesn't want a dissertation. He wants a short, fast answer. And that's what I'm trying to get you to learn how to do here, is to compress your knowledge into an answer that he can get in maybe 10 seconds, if not less than that. That's how you get strength with the boss, with the powerful people above you, is by having the knowledge to be able to lay out, here's what the answer is. Not here's what I think or here's some feelings I have on it. Here's what the answer is. And then shut your pie hole until you're asked something else, especially if you're asked to go out for drinks after work with the big dogs. That's what I'm doing here. Now, in the multiple choice and or in the short answers, I will probe you on some other issues regarding bonds. For example, I gave you a problem where I was asking where you had to calculate bond yields as the bond approached maturity. And I will explore that question again. What happens to bond yields or bond prices? I'm sorry, I should have said prices there. What happens to the price of a bond as the maturity date approaches? What happens to the price of the bond as the maturity date recedes? What happens to the price of a bond that is outstanding if the interest rate environment goes up? What happens to the price of a bond if the interest rate environment goes down? Those are kinds of questions that I might ask you. I might also, in the multiple choice, throw at you a simple question. Well, all the other things being held equal, which would have a higher present value? An annuity or an annuity due? Right, because you're getting one of the payments right away. That's all there is to it. Okay, that's all there is to it. Nothing complicated about that. Which has a higher yield, a bond that pays a coupon annually or a bond that pays a coupon semi-annually? And why? I thought you were springing a leak there, son. No. Yeah. Why? Why? Yeah, more frequently. It's not a huge change, but it's enough of a change that you have to notice it. You note it. And those are the kinds of things that I could probe. More like, it's technical, but it's the kind of stuff that you kind of want to get inside of you on a more of a gut basis sort of thing. What else do you want to ask me? Go ahead. Make my day.
Can you give us some more examples of short answers?
Let's see. Another example of a short answer that I could... should I tell?
Yeah.
God, you're not going to respect me later. Well, I don't know. It may not be a Friday night, but I have my electronic cigarette handy. Yeah, that was good. Okay. Huh? Yeah, but unfortunately, these things pack a wallop. I made the mistake of buying one with a full filter. I took this big drink, and I just felt my face. Anyway, what the hell? Okay, here we go. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did have just another thought that I wanted to probe in this is the whole idea of, in this second part of the course, I've probed the idea of optimal capital structure. Now, I'm going to ask you something about optimal capital structure in the short answers. It is going to be so stupid, the answer, that you might be absolutely convinced that that could not possibly be the answer. That's all I want to tell you. But it's going to be a question that looks open, vague, but it has a very specific, very simple answer to it.
What kind of specific, simple answer?
A very specific, simple answer. And I think you'll recognize it. You'll say, wait a minute, this is a really vague question. I could write a lot about that. Wait a minute, that turkey said... that there was a question that looked open and vague, but it had a very specific, simple answer. I hope you'll recognize that it looks open and vague until you realize what I'm asking you about. What am I asking you? And then it should clear up right away. Ah, this is a very straightforward answer. This is almost one of those ones where you write D-U-H question mark. You asked me to give you? Huh? No, because you won't get half credit at the board meeting if that's the answer you give. But I do want to give you the heads up. I gave the other class another heads up that on another question, and this is the heads up that I'll give you on this question.
So talk to them.
Huh? No, I already gave them another heads up on another question, and I. So you've got one now that they don't have. You two, that would be like oil and water. You two classes are so friggin' different. It creeps me out. I think I'm in like two different universes with your two classes. I mean, I don't know what it is. If you guys have got something really good in your water in your dorm, or I don't know, but it's just a very different, trust me. Coffee's excited. What else? Come on. I did forget one thing. I mentioned just a technical. There will be a couple of true-false in the multiple choice. I always do that. That's your 50-50 if you don't know the answer. Okay. So there are a couple of those. Go ahead.
Can we go over how you do... the quiz we just got back today, the one we just turned in.
The fixed cost?
Yes.
I won't ask you that.
Okay, never mind.
That was, you know, F-I. Yes. So you don't want to know about it on an intellectual level. Okay. Okay, fine. So much for academic curiosity. Now, a couple of things. If you're wondering, will I do a CAPM? I asked that on the first exam. I probe CAPM on the first exam. So I wouldn't actually give you a beta and stuff like that for you to have to design an interest rate. I'll just give you your interest rates, okay? Now, a few other little odds and ends. Back to the multiple choice, just to throw one there at you. Tell me. Two projects can't be done together. What do you call it? All right, very good. That's all there is to it. Now, excuse me. Wait. I got to quit here in just a few minutes. That, you know, that country song, that country western song, and the thunder rolls. Any minute, the lightning's about to strike. Okay. I want to make sure you don't ignore some of what seemed like a little bit less more theoretical, speculative kinds of conversation. Remember I talked to you about the idea, why would it, related in a way to Modigliani-Miller, was this idea, why would a company ever pay a dividend? The thing about it logically, what's the point of paying a dividend? A company is giving away money that it could use to pay for capital projects. And it's just handing it to its investors? What's that about?
Well, we feel that our investors should have some of this money so that they could possibly find their own investments.
Well, that's what it seems. Why are you saying you don't have any ideas about how to use that $400,000 you're giving out in dividends? Talk to me. I've got some great ideas. Someone might even make some darn good money. As long as I can get connected back up with those guys I knew from South Asia. But the thing is, why would a company give a dividend? The company is almost like saying, we haven't got any ideas about how to get a good ROE on this money. So, but we see dividends given out all the time. Companies are punished by the investment community if they suspend a dividend or if they don't grow the dividend the way the investment community expects them to. So what is going on with the dividend? Why is it happening? And the answer comes back down to that idea of signaling. That is essentially the signaling of a market. That there is clearly, the company can afford to do this. The company can do this. I didn't tell you the story, but I had mentioned it to the other class. Some years back, I was invited to a Christmas party of one of the Alphabet houses. And I had mentioned Alphabet houses are those big insurance brokerage firms that work with the giant companies, that represent the giant companies to insurance companies. So that like Wendy's International or some other company like that goes to a brokerage house. And the producers, these very fancy salesmen and these staffs work with the insurance companies to design insurance packages. Well, I went to an Alphabet house Christmas party. They were handing out the best cigars I had ever seen at a corporate gathering. They had caviar, which it actually does taste like shit. And it really is true that you have to chase it with vodka. And it doesn't matter if the vodka is really bad. That covers the taste of the caviar even better. But they were handing out all these treats, and food was just amazing. I mean, they had these giant pots of little lamb chops and this giant prime rib. And I just carved off half of it and went back to my table. Why would they do that? I would have taken a White Owl cigar. You know, if it had been some ground burger that said Mr. Ed on it, I would have eaten it. I'm not proud. Why would they do this? It's a signal. We can do this. This was the first time in my life, and I did see it a couple of times after that. I saw one of the big wigs of the company. He was sitting out there talking about what a great year they'd had, and that son of a bitch actually did light a $100 bill and lit his giant cigar with that $100 bill. And I was going... But it's a signal. We can do this. It's the same reason when you get a little older and you've got money, you'll give out great gifts. You don't need to give out the great gifts, but when you give out the great gifts, you're essentially saying, bite me. I can do this. And you couldn't give me anything even worth a tenth of what I'm giving you, so who's your daddy? Okay, that's essentially, there is an aspect, that signaling aspect. That's an important thing. And I'll probe those kinds of ideas. What's going on behind the scene when we see processes that don't sometimes make sense to us? Why is it that when everyone thought interest rates were going to go up, we saw the number of applications for home loans go up? Interest rates were going up, and yet the home loan applications were going through the roof. Why would that be? That violates the law of demand. When the interest rates go up, quantity demanded should go down. So when interest rates go up, the quantity demanded of home loans should go down, and yet it was going up. Why would that happen? What does finance have to tell us about that kind of stuff? What's the answer? Gasoline just went up 50 cents a gallon, and everyone's lined up to buy it. Why?
Because you have to.
No.
You need gas? I don't know.
No. Yes. Expectation. Markets don't work on history. They work on the future. Their best guess of what the future is. And interestingly enough, they will, in an interest rate environment that's rising, you will see borrowers rush to grab higher interest rates because they are afraid that they will become even higher later. That rising interest rate is confirming their fear of rising interest rates, so they will move towards those rising interest rates. And it seems like it's perverse, but it's based upon expectations. Now, the last thing that I would encourage you to think about for this exam, and I wrote down a quick note here. There was one other one that I was going to, I forgot to mention on the quantitative. I will do a stock pricing problem, okay? Stock price. And those are easy calculations, obviously. But I won't ask about doing CAPM, though. That's just outside of the scope of this exam. Do you have any questions for me? Any other questions at all? Yes. Say that again. D1 over K minus G. No, because I don't want my tires slashed on my nice Subaru Forester. Really? Yeah. I mean, you know, I can throw problems at you. I had this guy, he'd been my student at Heartland. He comes to me last semester with this question that was given to him as a homework. I swear to God, by the time I was finished with that, I couldn't find my own butt using both hands in a roadmap. It doesn't prove anything to me that you can do that kind of a problem. You come to me in the next finance course, I'll beat your ass for those problems. Now, no. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.